Right now, the Secretary General of NATO, Jaap de Hoop Scheffer, is in New York this week for the meeting of the United Nations General Assembly. At the top of his agenda, Afghanistan. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization took over responsibility for security in that country last summer. NATO involvement continues in Iraq, Kosovo, and Darfur, among other troubled spots around the globe. If you have questions for Jaap de Hoop Scheffer about Afghanistan, NATO's relationship with Russia, Iraq, or expansion of the alliance, give us a call, 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. And Mr. Secretary General, welcome and thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much. Good to be on the show.
Well, it's good to have you. Can you talk to us about NATO's number one priority and challenge, which is Afghanistan? NATO has, 30,000 troops in Afghanistan?
Almost 40,000.
Almost 40,000.
As we speak of 26, all 26 NATO allies and about 11, 12 partners. So close to 40 nations, NATO allies and partners are active in Afghanistan.
And how do you describe the challenge there? And do you agree that this is NATO's number one priority?
I do agree. It's NATO's most important operation. It is an operation under the cover of the Security Council of the United Nations. The UN has come to NATO to lead this peacekeeping operation for them. We have seen great successes in Afghanistan, as we also know, more particularly in the south, as the southern part of the country. It's tough from time to time because there are unfortunately too many spoilers who do not want to see a reconstruction, who do not want to see nation building, and who we have to engage militarily from time to time. So it's a challenge, but if you realize that 80% of the Afghans have access to health care, that millions of children are going to school, 6 million, about one-third girls, that thousands of kilometers of road has been built, power stations, a democratically elected president. So let's not be gloomy about Afghanistan.
Well, I don't want to be gloomy, but let me try and you're looking at the glass half full, and I guess it's the job of journalists every now and then to sort of say, to look at the glass half empty. I mean, you mentioned it's tough in the south. The Taliban is fighting back. The fighting is hard. The authority of the central government doesn't extend that far beyond Kabul. Is NATO winning in Afghanistan?
Well, first of all, if you ask me, is NATO winning? Let me make a small amendment to your question. Is the international community winning? Because NATO, of course, provides these 40,000 forces, but NATO is no development cooperation agency, nor a reconstruction company. We can provide a climate of security and stability. Large parts of the country are much more secure and stable. It's not that the U.S. or Belgium or the Netherlands. In the south, it's tough. But given the fact that Afghanistan is also one of the front lines in our fight against terrorism, we simply cannot afford to fail, and we will not fail.
What about the challenge of convincing other countries to take on a bigger role in Afghanistan? How serious a challenge is this? I know your countrymen, the Dutch, the Canadians are engaged in a difficult fighting in the south, but you would like to see other countries take on a bigger role there, wouldn't you?
Well, as we speak, we have seen over the past few months an increase in the force levels. I consider it my job as the NATO Secretary General never to be completely and entirely satisfied, so we can always do with more helicopters and more fixed-wing aircraft, and more is better here. So you'll not see me concluding that I'm happy and satisfied. But on the other hand, we must not negate the fact that all 26 allies are active in one way or another in Afghanistan. All 26 of them, that is the total NATO alliance.
But are all 26 of them willing to take on the hard fighting in the south, for example?
Well, not all 26 of them are in the south. And there is a difference, of course, in atmosphere in between the parts of the country. But there are a lot of allies, by the way, not only the Canadians and the Dutch, but many more who are active in the south. The NATO allies have promised each other that in situations where there's a real urgency, they'll come to each other's help and assistance. So in principle, in an emergency situation, you can see all NATO forces going everywhere.
We're talking to Secretary General of NATO, Jaap de Hoop Scheffer. He joins us from New York. And you can join the conversation by calling 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK if you have a question for the Secretary General. Let's take a call from Syed, who's calling from Jacksonville, Florida. Syed, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I would like to ask the Secretary General, about the ongoing problems of the landmines that the Russians have left behind in Afghanistan. I know that we're facing the terrorists and the Taliban and a lot of corruption in the government right now, but those landmines that the Russians placed are still killing and injuring thousands of children and held, you know, it's holding up a lot of progress in the country.
Sure, Syed, let's put the question.
What are the Russians doing about this?
Yeah, let's let the Secretary General answer that. What do you think, Mr. Secretary General, about the landmines?
Well, I think Syed is very right that landmines are an enormous problem in Afghanistan, not only in Afghanistan, by the way. There are many, unfortunately, many countries in the world where conflict has raged and where you see many, many landmines. NATO as such is not only, of course, responsible for clearing areas of landmines. What is important is that indicating the areas where the mines are, and I fully agree that we should do everything we can to clear Afghanistan of mines. Unfortunately, I say again, NATO cannot do everything. NATO learns in Afghanistan that there are many other international organizations necessary, that they are active, that they are committed to Afghanistan to get that country back on its feet again. But I entirely agree with the analysis. The only thing I can't promise that I'll have the immediate solution at hand, but people are killed, children are getting killed. You're absolutely right.
Syed, thanks for the call. Let's go to Bill, who's calling from Jackson, Wyoming. Hello, Bill.
Hi. My question is, one of the most intractable problems in Afghanistan seems to be the opium trade, and it seems to fund Taliban and Al-Qaeda in a lot of ways. And it seems to me a solution to that would be to buy the opium from the growers and turn it into morphine for places that don't have medicine, like places in Africa. There was a front page story in the New York Times last week about a poor lady who was ill and there was no morphine to ease her pain. And it seems to me that's a way to solve the problem.
So, Bill, you would suggest teaming up with the opium growers, essentially, and becoming allies with them or making them our allies.
Well, morphine is one of the products of opium. You know, it doesn't have to be turned into heroin.
Sure. Mr. Secretary General, what do you think about Bill's suggestion?
Well, it has been under discussion now for quite some time. I'm not a fan of doing this, quite honestly. I'm saying at the same time that, NATO does not have and does not seek prime responsibility for countering narcotics. I agree, it's a huge problem in Afghanistan, because the country is, I think, providing 95-96% of the total world production of opium. The problem here is one of price. There are nations like India where there are illicit drugs available at $30 a kilo. The farmers can get 100. Point number two, counter-argument number two against this thesis would be that there is basically no world demand. Why? Because the third world, Africa, is not as used as Americans or Europeans to taking morphine, to taking drugs. In other words, I do not think the demand is there. Point number three, suppose that you would buy the crop, which will cost you about $1 billion a year. Who is going to pay for this? How long can you sustain this? How can you prevent poppy farmers, where the opium comes from, not to cover the whole nation? In other words, it sounds very sympathetic and serving a good purpose in Africa and elsewhere, but quite honestly, I do not think it's feasible, and I'm in the good company of the United Nations Office on Drugs here, who also think this is not a road we should go.
Well, Bill, thanks for the call. Let's go to Rob, who is calling from San Jose, California. Hi, Rob.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Thanks for the call. What's your question?
I wanted to ask the Secretary General how he sees NATO's role in the modern world. NATO obviously came about largely because of its opposition to the Warsaw Pact countries and perhaps in general American opposition to the Soviet Union. And now that the Soviet Union has collapsed and we're in a more multipolar world, what is NATO's role?
That's a great question, Mr. Secretary General. Yeah, NATO was formed to counter the Soviet Union, which is no longer. What is its core mission today?
NATO is extremely busy, more busy than it has ever been in its history. Its core mission is still, and it will always stay like that and be like that, is still to be a political-military alliance on the basis of solidarity, on the basis of what we call integrated defense. You integrate your defense forces. On the basis of an attack against one is an attack against all. That will not change. Having said that, the analysis is absolutely right. There's no Soviet Union anymore. Russia is a NATO partner and not an enemy anymore, as it was during the Cold War. NATO is as busy as ever. As we speak, do realize that NATO has more than 55,000 men and women in uniform in many missions and operations across the globe. You have mentioned a few, from Afghanistan to Kosovo in the Western Balkans, still a very volatile area. We are assisting the African Union in Darfur by flying in and out the African Union forces. We run an anti-terrorist naval operation in the Mediterranean. We have a training mission in Iraq to train the Iraqi security forces. We went to Pakistan after the earthquake to provide humanitarian assistance. We went to New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. It's not your daddy's NATO anymore or my daddy's NATO anymore, but it's an alliance which is as busy as ever. And more, and that's the reason that I speak to you from the headquarters of the United Nations, more and more, the United Nations calls on NATO to run these peacekeeping operations on behalf of the United Nations. So I think we're definitely not looking for more work. We try to do the work we have to do as good and as best as we can.
We're talking to Jaap de Hoop Scheffer, Secretary General of NATO, about the Atlantic Alliance, about its future and its many obligations around the world. If you have a question for the Secretary General, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's take a call from Ryan, who's calling from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hi, Ryan. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a question regarding how realistic it is that Ukraine will join NATO within the next 10 years, which is the hope of Viktor Yushchenko. And if not, what does Ukraine need to do to make it more realistic for it to join NATO? And won't that divide relations between NATO and Russia, as Russia sees this as an infringement upon its sphere of influence? And I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ryan. Mr. Secretary General.
Well, I think to come back to the last part of the question, I think we should not anymore think in terms of spheres of influence. That is Cold War thinking. I always say the rule of law and democracy spreading in Europe can never be a bad thing. So nobody should be worried about the enlargement of NATO. And that is relevant for Ukraine as it is relevant for other European nations. In Ukraine, as you know, at the moment, there is a bit of a complex situation. There will be elections at the end of this month. There are people who would like to see Ukraine in NATO. There are others who do not like to see that. It is up to the Ukrainian people, finally, to decide what course they want to follow. In the meantime, NATO has an intense relationship with Ukraine. We have what we call an intensified dialogue with them, and the word exactly says what it is, an intensified and intense dialogue. We have many common projects. Ukrainian forces participate in NATO's peacekeeping operations. If and when that will lead to membership, I don't know. That's very difficult to say. Again, I say it's first of all up to the Ukrainian people to decide what they want and to what group of nations they do want to belong to. They have European Union aspirations and ambitions as well, as you know. And then, as far as NATO is concerned, it is a matter of performance. NATO membership doesn't come for free. You have to perform. You have to reform. But again, I think as far as Ukraine is concerned, it's still a bit early in the day to answer the question in a more definite sense about Ukrainian membership. Let's use our partnership with Ukraine to the full. Let me commend Ukraine strongly for the way they participate in peacekeeping operations. And let the democratic process in Ukraine have its course. I mean, Ukraine has only recently, after the Orange Revolution, become what it is, and we're following, of course, development with the greatest interest. But like in the U.S., it's up to the Ukrainian people to decide what course they want to follow.
Thanks for the call, Ryan. Mr. Secretary General, you mentioned spheres of influence and talking about spheres of influence as a sort of dated way to talk about the world. How should we talk about the world? And the reason I ask this is, as we consider the Atlantic Alliance expanding and possibly one day including countries like Ukraine or Georgia, for example, there are ongoing talks. Russia does still feel threatened by NATO expansion. Isn't that a concern? And aren't we talking there about spheres of influence?
Let me react to your word threatened, because I repeat, who can feel threatened by the spread of democracy, universal values and the rule of law? I don't get that, quite honestly, that anybody would feel threatened. Having said that, let's do away with the old times rhetoric of spheres of influence. NATO is not seeking a sphere of influence. Any nation which is aspiring to become a NATO member does that from its own free will. NATO will never force membership or partnership on any of those nations. At the same time, if there is a perception in Moscow and in Russia that this is a process about which they have worries, Russia is our partner. We have the NATO-Russia Council, where we meet with the Russians at ambassadorial level or at ministerial level. I had a conversation with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov this morning here at the United Nations headquarters. I can't say we agree on everything and about everything, but we have a mechanism. We are partners for 10 years now, where we can also discuss things we do not agree upon. And that is more important than looking each other into our blue or brown eyes and say we do agree. In other words, the meets do not mind. The minds do not meet, I should say, on NATO enlargement. Let's discuss it. Let's, on the other hand, realize that the NATO allies, 26 NATO allies, decide by themselves and exclusively on who is admitted to NATO and who's not.
Well, Mr. Secretary General, I want to thank you very much for your time today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. That's Jaap de Hoop Scheffer, Secretary General of NATO. He joined us today from a studio at the United Nations in New York. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Anthony Brooks.